Thank you, dear listener, for your kind attention to this pointless rambling. Forever Night is episodic, but this podcast is not. You're best served by starting at the introduction and going through in order. Thanks. Let's begin, shall we? Welcome to Still Dreaming, an existential journey through our Forever Night. We continue this week with episode 2 of the series. A continuation from last time, this is Dark Knight, the second chapter. It originally aired on May 6, 1992, directed by Alan Croker, written by James D. Perot and Barney Cohen. The synopsis, plundered from Wikipedia, reads simply this. Nick's search for the Jade Cup leads him to LaCroix, and Nick must choose between saving his newfound love's life or learning a ritual that may make him mortal again. Oh, Nick, what's a brooding vampire cop to do? Good evening, gentle listeners. Last we left our brooding hero, he was lost in memories of his past, torn between who he used to be and the self-aware creature that he is now. He was taunted on the radio by the Nightcrawler, LaCroix, the vampire who brought him across in the 13th century. Nick and his new partner, Don Skanky, still had not solved the mystery of the vampire-like killings that haunt Toronto's homeless population. Nick thinks the killings are related to the stolen Jade Cup, a Mayan artifact that may hold the key to curing his vampirism. As Nick contemplated his endless parade of nights and what it means for him to be an immortal creature of the night, we contemplated the writings of Albert Camus, notably the myth of Sisyphus. Why is he so damned happy? This episode opens up with Nick's meeting with LaCroix. Blues and blacks, the color palette of Forever Night. I'm still loving the look of the show, the color palette, the camera angles, just great. Now, I'd like to make a little note on how I'm going to handle this episode, which really has a lot happening in it in a very rapid sequence. I'm going to concentrate a little bit more on the actual plot of this episode, describing things that happen as they happened in the show. I think that relying on the story structure of this particular episode will help make our other points make a little more sense. I didn't do that so much with part one. And that's mainly because in part one, not a lot happens. It's not really the fault of the show. You have to establish the mythology and the characters. But now that we know who everyone is, and now we know what the mythology, or at least a part of the mythology, is for vampires in this universe, now we get to the mystery of the week. And a whole lot has to happen in order for us to get to the end credits. So it's a little bit different from part one. I'm going to be focused more on plot points, and then we'll be dissecting deeper meanings as we go along. As the episode begins, Nick is following LaCroix down a moody and foggy and entirely noir-looking alleyway. But uh-oh, the curator is there. She's following Nick. Why and how, I don't know. I mean, how do these two vampires with super hearing not hear her scuttling up the alleyway behind them? And as another little side note, I never knew Toronto was so foggy. And Elise is right behind Nick as he dramatically sashays down the alleyway to this convenient slaughterhouse? I'm not sure what it's supposed to be. It's definitely beyond belief that LaCroix and Nick don't know she's there. Anyway, this warehouse, slaughterhouse set, whatever it is cool. There's a nice green lighting introduced into the color palette. Again, I wonder, though, aren't they in the city? Are there just meat packing plants with hanging pig carcasses and barrels of blood in the middle of Toronto? I've been to Canada, but never specifically Toronto. Anyway, I mean, it's a cool-looking set. Metal, diagonal angles, gloomy lighting. It looks like the kind of place I'd like to listen to Nine Inch Nails and take black-and-white photographs when I was 16. This confrontation begins. Tilted camera angles and shadows tell us that Lacroix is the bad guy, as though his haircut didn't tell us this already. "I moved here especially for you," Lacroix says. He's been seeking Nick out. "Immortality," Lacroix says, "I gave that to you." "We need to trust each other," he says. "You can't deny what you are." Nick, a vampire in the 20th century, stands before his maker, confronted with a choice. Embrace what he is, or continue to seek his fool's quest. Nicholas, disillusioned with life in the 13th century, seeks a greater purpose, more immortality, with Jeanette and Lacroix. Instead of escaping the human condition, the imminence of death, he finds the true condition of humanity, lack of meaning, the absurd. He is consigned to the life of an animal, a creature hunting and feeding with no promise of release from the cycle. He seeks mortality again because mortality gives the promise of death, of completion, and possibly even meaning. Becoming a vampire didn't elevate him above humanity. It made him the ultimate human, destined to an endless life of repetitive motions, fleeting friendships, empty motions, an endless parade of nights. Nick is self-aware enough to be saddened by the burden of the rock he pushes up the hill. He gains no peace watching it tumble back down again. But what of Lacroix? Is he our metaphorical Sisyphus? No. He is also living a delusion. He thinks himself to be a king, but he's only the alpha dog of a small pack of wandering mongrels. "Humans all have to die," he tells Nick. "What does it matter if it's sooner or later?" Rather ironic words from somebody fleeing from death himself. He embraces his savage violence. It's his source of power. He's deluded in his sense of grandeur. But feeling like a king doesn't make you a king. Nick sees the emperor has no clothes, but how to escape this empire of forever night. You can't deny what you are. Can we? Can we ever? Lacroix threatens to kill Nick with all the ease and flippancy of a good villain. He thoughtfully establishes the rules for vampires in this universe for us, the audience. What can kill them, and so on. In the struggle, Elise is threatened by Lacroix, but saved by Nick. In the process, the jade cup is smashed. Nick chooses love over mortality. And Lacroix is staked through the heart with a metal rail. "I made you a god. I made you my brother," Lacroix says. "I shall repay you," replies Nick. And with that, Lacroix is dead. Yep, he's dead. Sure is dead, all right. I totally believe that he is completely and totally dead. Anyway, suddenly it's daytime and Elise is long gone. Nick stumbles to his car, smoke billowing out from under his clothes as he makes his way to the caddy, pops the trunk, and jumps in. Nick's trunk has the same blue lighting that we've seen other places. Nice feature. So Camus Sisyphus asks, "Why should I not kill myself?" His work, The Rebel, asks, "Why should I not kill others?" Ultimately, these are the two main questions at the core of Forever Night. Why should Nick reject his vampirism and stop killing humans? Why shouldn't he just let himself be consumed by the sun, sacrificing himself and securing final release from his struggle? Nick is a believer in something. An afterlife, the concept of salvation, the promise of absolution. His cursed condition marks him as a creature of sin and selfishness, who kills to sustain and to entertain, who, if he embraced his nature the way Lacroix has, could be completely stripped of humanity and compassion. For whatever reason, Nick still has compassion. He still has hope, and this is what damns him. Wisdom, Camus writes in Nuptials, is, quote, conscious certainty of death without hope, end quote. Nothing in this world matters except the right now, the right here, the immediacy of the present. Nick constantly yearns for an impossible transcendent future while chained to the events of his past. Until Nick can find peace in the absurdity of the now, there will never be peace for him. Camus writes that hope is disastrous for humans, inasmuch as it leads them to minimize the value of this life except as preparation for a life beyond. Nick's hope for salvation is precisely what damns him. His current quest for mortality is a deference, a way of not negotiating the present, not accepting his current state. He pushes his rock up the hill angrily, already knowing it will fall, already hating it for doing so, and therefore not feeling the life in his veins. Probably a bad metaphor for the subject. The present pleasures of the struggle, the endless possibility of the right now. When I first had this thought, it was a bit of a revelation and completely changed how I thought about Forever Night. I now see this series as a commentary on existentialism and the absurd, using the metaphor of vampirism to illustrate how people lose sight of the beautiful importance of the current moment in their struggle to overcome a past that doesn't exist anymore, or to get a better position in a future that doesn't yet exist. I may be the only person who thinks that, but here it is. And here you are listening to it. So, you know, thanks. Nick is hiding from the sun in the trunk of his car, and there's a metaphor in there somewhere too. He's been gone for so long, his car has been towed to the station, and Skanky's going to drive it, because he wants to. Skanky's got a semi over this car, but I had noticed no real concern at all for the missing Nick. He just wants to joyride. Skanky drives the caddy to the hospital to follow up on some leads on the murders. Nick comes to in the trunk, hops out, and snoops around a doctor's computer while Skanky's at the nurse's station. And Nick is totally comfortable using a computer database on a machine that isn't his and presumably hasn't been trained on in 1992. Is Mick a Mary Sue? Am I using that term correctly? Back at the car, the murderer tampers with the brakes. Nick is back in the trunk. Skanky starts driving. He's listening to polka, because he's Polish, you get it? The polka music makes Nick writhe in agony, and I laugh, because I feel his pain. This is the exciting action moment for the episode. Hang on. Don't blink, or you'll miss it. Brakes are failing. Remember, the murderer has cut them. Skanky is careening out of control, whipping the caddy across lanes, overdubbed horns blaring and screeching tire sounds as Nick is tossed around in the trunk. And cut to commercial. Back from commercial, and apparently the writers forgot that they were supposed to resolve that tension for us because it is anticlimactic as fuck. At the police station, in the garage again, Skanky, who still doesn't know where Nick is, or if he's in trouble or not, is only concerned with how much it's going to cost him to fix the caddy. Nick finds the perfect time when no one is around to pop out of the car, gets sort of fake mad at Skanky, but then realizes that Skanky's theory about the murder case was actually right all along, and now they're buddies. Still no concern over where Nick was this whole time. I tell you what, guys, that's efficient storytelling, and I kind of love it. The crash part I didn't love because it was mostly lame. But, you know, the buddy cop thing, it works for me. Now, to emphasize this, though, our police detective, Don Skanky, never asks Nick where he was or how he got back to the station. And Nick has not done any vampire mind tricks on him yet. Guys, Donnie is not a good dick. So cut to Nick's apartment, and Elise is there. She knows the code to get in his door, which confused me at first, but then I remembered Nick said his code was from the Mayan hieroglyphics, and later we did see Hunter deciphering them to get the code. So there was a setup and payoff there, even if it was a bit roundabout. She's stalking him, apparently. She knows he's a vampire at this point. She saw him with LaCroix, and LaCroix almost killed her. She finds one of the murderer's victims still alive near the apartment and calls the hospital, but gasp, it's the murderer coming and not an ambulance. And I'm skipping a lot of details here because you probably have a good idea what's going to happen, don't you? I do want to pause to reflect on 1980s, 1990s TV trope of the answering machine. What a great dramatic device. Our characters can miss important information by leaving home just before the important call comes, but can get access to the message by calling their machine later in the episode so they know what they need to know before the final commercial break. And that's what happens. Nick and Skanky figure out who the killer is. Nick decides this is a great time to check his messages before they go looking for the bad guy. Elise, in the apartment, hears Nick access his machine and picks up the phone, allowing Nick to hear exactly when the killer arrives and attacks. Nick scrambles, yelling at Skanky to take the car, dashing out the door. Skanky yells, "How are you going to get there, fly?" Nick is not good at hiding. He's a vampire. And Skanky is not good at detectiving. So the killer, he's nuts, like super, totally bozo nuts. Apparently, he's totally normal at work, but right now, he's nuttier than a fruitcake. Struggle, fight, struggle. Elise is thrown aside. The homeless girl fends off the killer with fire, and now Nick's loft is on fire. Does this ever come up again? Like, will there be fire and smoke damage in his place in episode 3? I need to remember to look for that. And, of course, LaCroix is there. Is he going to save the day? Wouldn't that just be great? So, the death of LaCroix was at the beginning of the episode, and did that fool anyone? After LaCroix made a point of saying a wooden stake through the heart kills a vampire, and then he's run through with metal, did anyone think LaCroix was for real dead? It's hard to imagine anyone was falling for that. Nick and LaCroix scuffle. The flames grow. Nick and Elise are trapped by the fire. Nick is weak because he hasn't fed on blood in a long time. And then Elise makes an offer. "Take me," she says. For fuck's sake. I'd had a facepalm, guys, really, when that happened. "Take me. Jesus Christ. Take me. I want to live forever. Blah, blah, blah." LaCroix chimes in. "Mortals die. What does it matter how or when?" And Jesus, this is a long conversation to have in a literal burning house. So what you think is going to happen, happens. Nick looks like he might give in, but of course he does not. He leaps through the flames. LaCroix bites Elise, and then Nick stabs LaCroix through with a burning stake like a boss. And this time, LaCroix is engulfed in flames, and eventually crumbles into a pile of burning goth clothes. Toast. So, I mean, spoilers, I guess. Lacroix comes back. But how they're going to explain this is going to be interesting, because he's fucking dead. Destroyed, even. How does he come back from that? Well, we won't find out now, because now is the point in the episode where we wrap things up. This ending feels really quick, rushed. Suddenly, they're at the museum. The remaining cup is returned. There's some dialogue about what happened to people off-screen. It's all pretty flat. This is the reset at the end of the episode. We're moving on. Nick and Nat, though, still have that chemistry I loved so much from the first episode. She talks about trying to help him with his condition. He makes a comment about him never being able to be in love. I mean, fuck, Nick. Twist the knife. And then suddenly, mood change. Just instantly. He gets really handsy with Nat, given everything he's just said. Morose and sorrowful over the loss of, at the chance of his humanity one second. Then flirty and touchy with Nat the next. Natalie, in this scene, is Dr. Exposition. Gives us the thesis statement of the show, practically. She, Nick, and Skanky leave to jazzy sax music, but surprise, Elise is a vampire. Fuck! Does she ever come back? Well, probably not. Okay. Wonderful, low-budget, quick wrap-this-up ending. It's a little anticlimactic, but it's so TV cliché. Boy, that sure was exciting when the thing happened off-screen that provided the resolution to the problem we're facing. Too bad that chick totally died in your apartment. Ha ha ha, vampire joke. Let's get Slovakia. Skanky's Polish, get it? Guys, it's bad. And Jesus Christ, I fucking love it. But I'm tickled by it now because Forever Night is this thing I've mythologized. And it's meaningful to me in a way I can't fully articulate. And now I see it for its cheesy, cliched glory, and I'm still enjoying the sugar rush. Can this high maintain me over the next 68 episodes? Who's going to bring me down? Camus, that's who. So before we ask the question, why is Sisyphus happy? Sisyphus's labor is a triumph. Sisyphus hates death. But his passion for life in accepting its absurdity. Sisyphus is at his strongest when he watches the boulder tumble down and then trots along after it. He has a tragic consciousness. He is living fully aware of the bitterness of our being and consciously facing our fate. Sisyphus lives out what has been imposed on him, thus making it his own. Happiness and the absurd are two sons of the same earth. They are inseparable, writes Camus. We are fully alive when we embrace the struggle in spite of or because of its futility. One must imagine Sisyphus happy. When Lacroix says you cannot deny what you are, he's of course lying. We often deny what we are. Lacroix himself denies what he is. He says to Nick, I made you a god. Of course he didn't. If he transcended Nick at all, he transcended him to a level of more human than human. A wretched state. Only wretched not because of its essential nature, wretched because of Nick's essential delusion and longing for meaning outside of himself. What Lacroix and Nick both don't understand is that this quest for a meaning outside of themselves will always be ultimately futile. They will never find that transcendence. They will never find that meaning. Lacroix has a far different attitude than Nick, of course. His delusion is of a different sort than Nick's. But they're both deluded. They're both the forlorn Sisyphus in their different ways. Lacroix pretends at being happy, but he's not, because he lives in a delusion. And if the delusion gives him a sense of purpose, even if it is just an illusionary purpose, then maybe that's all Lacroix needs. But we see that Nick is of not that same sort. Nick is still striving, still looking, still seeking, but he will always find the universe persistently silent when it comes to an answer. Happiness and the absurd are two suns of the same earth. We are fully alive when we embrace the struggle in spite of or because of its futility. Will Nick ever learn that lesson? We have 68 more episodes to find out. Until then, one must imagine Sisyphus quite happy. So, here we are. My first time seeing the two-part pilot for Forever Night, and my first time back to this series in a very long time. So, my impressions. I enjoyed it. There are definitely parts of the show that show its age and lack of budget. Early 90s TV writing stands out, especially at the end. Overall, though, it was a treat. I liked getting to know Nick again. It brought a smile to my face to see Jeanette, even though it's very brief. And Skanky, even though he was a jerk for most of it. Natalie was the highlight, although she was barely in part two and served mainly as exposition delivery. I still like the actress's delivery and her chemistry with Nick. I hope the melodrama gets dialed back a touch. I felt like Geraint when Babies was leaving fang marks on the scenery a couple times. Same thing with Lacroix, but somehow that seems more appropriate with his character. As the beginning of the series, it sets up a lot of promise. There's a lot here to dive into the character. We'll see if there's any carryover on the themes or events from these episodes to the next, or if it's a total reset to square one. When I watch episode 3 of Forever Night, titled For I Have Sinned, next week. And now, a brief word from our sponsor. Still Dreaming is a podcast hosted and recorded by me in the newly revamped CERK Internet Radio Studio. Forever Night was produced for CBS by Glenn Warren Productions and Sony Pictures Television. All rights reserved.